which are left with Allah. We cannot give rational explanations for everything. You know, Ali radiallahu anhu had said that if the religion were based on reason, rational thought, and this was the whole of the religion, this is the fundamental base of everything, then the bottom of the socks should be wiped and not the top. You know, when we make wudu and we wipe our socks in place of washing our feet, the bottom should be washed, wiped, and not the top. However, he said, I saw the Messenger of Allah wipe the top, not the bottom. So, you know, we understand that there are limits to man's ability to explain rationally everything. And there are dangers in trying to do that. People start to twist the meaning behind practices. And they can find themselves in a fix. I mean, I know of one particular case where this is how Islam was presented to a particular individual in Washington, that everything was rational, you could explain everything. And after he learned that, you know, when you make wudu, when you pass wind, that you have to make wudu all over again, this appeared to him to be irrational. And he asked people to explain to him rationally how this is, why. Everything else seemed to make sense, but didn't seem to make sense. It didn't make sense. You've just washed because you explain rationally when you're making wudu, you're washing these parts of your body which are normally exposed, and you finish and you pass wind, you go and you wash these parts off. Did you get these parts dirty? No. So why are you washing it all over again? So he just jammed him up. And it was then he left Islam because of it. We pray that he would find his way back eventually. But the reality, we cannot try to rationally deal with every single aspect of Islam. Much of it is very rational, very reasonable, very practical. But there are aspects of it known only to Allah. He has commanded us to do them. We believe that there is a good reason for them, but we may not be able to understand. Yawm al-Qiyamah, these things may be revealed to us. We seek to understand it, what Allah wishes to reveal.
How would you comment about the determination of sex in the world and the morals of our society?
Well, if you see the verses, you know, the verses which refer to it talk about a series of things. It's not just sex, right? Yeah. And when a child is initially conceived, ultrasound cannot determine the sex of that child. Even in the early development of the child, though, you know, they take samples of the amniotic fluid and they analyze it to try to determine, this, they tell you, is not 100% sure. It's still partially guesswork. They say this one's going to be a boy and it turns out to be a girl. They say it's going to be a girl, it turns out to be a boy. So they do not have clear knowledge. In terms of ultrasound, this is, you know, when the child is developed to a certain point.
What you would get from those
So what it is referring to in terms of the womb of the woman here, you know, and also in the verses, it refers to what, whether a child will be born dead, whether it will be born alive. Yes, there's reference, there's actually clear reference to that in other verses. When you put all the verses together, I mean, this, we find this reference is there. What is in the womb? What is in the womb in what sense? This is one aspect of it that we are not able to say. We cannot say who will be born. Ma taghidu al-arham.
You know?
In the general sense. We may seed the clouds and rain comes. But not every cloud which is seeded rains. The weatherman, he predicts, because it rained in Jordan and that cloud is coming here, it's going to rain here too. Oftentimes he's correct, but sometimes he's not. So our knowledge may, you know, give us, put us in a position where we're able to predict things a bit more, you know, to some degree, but it is not real knowledge in the sense of absolute knowledge. We don't have that absolute knowledge. Well, scientifically, you know, they've shown, and not to say this is the reason and the only reason, they've shown that, you know, it is the main carrier of trichinosis, particular disease, you know, called that particular worm which sets itself in the flesh of the pig, and it requires very high degrees of cooking, you know, at high temperatures for this to be killed. Most people, you know, they're not able to on a normal stove to reach these temperatures. But you see, still we understand that it goes beyond that, because if somebody says to you, well, okay, you've got, you know, a very powerful oven here, now we're going to cook it at this temperature, are you ready? So we say no, because just because we have found one of the harms doesn't mean that this was the one and only harm. No, they've also told people who have heart disease, they're told, you know, not to eat pork because it has high degree of fat, you know, which is deposited in your system. Also, scientists in recent times have also shown that we are not able to break down pig fat. The fat of the cow and the goat, we have the enzymes to break it right on down and reassemble it in our bodies. Pig fat is broken down to smaller molecules, but it is redeposited in the system as is. There's the one Dr. Ahmed Saqar in the States. He's done extensive, he's a nutritionist. He's done extensive research on that. He has a book on it, you know, showing scientifically. And it's not just pig fat, there's certain other animals too. The carnivorous animals, you know, which are also prohibited to eat, have this quality of. So there may be something else which, you know, comes from it. Or, you know, as some scholars have pointed out, you know, this is now reasoning that you are what you eat. What you eat, you're using to build your system up with. Certain animals carry certain characteristics which are part of their natures. You break this animal down in your body and you rebuild yourself with it. It could affect. No. Well, we can say pork, animals which die of themselves in one way or another, either by strangling, falling, being gored, the variety of different ways. Basically, it's pork and animals which die of themselves. But then the Prophet ﷺ, based on revelation, expanded that to include carnivorous animals, you know, whether birds or land animals. No. Aquatic animals are considered to be all halal, except edible. Because we know the sea has certain qualities. An animal which dies in the sea, we eat. We eat a fish without slaughtering it. Everything else we have to slaughter. You know? But the fish It dies of itself and we eat it. Well, not to the dog, but you say it when you send the dog.
Sorry. When you send the dog. I thought you
it's not really takbir though, it's bismillah.
Yeah. And then that game is on halal, although you are not slaughtered.
If you find it alive when you find the animal, if it's still living, then you slaughter it. If it is already dead, you are allowed to eat it. You see, because that's why we are saying that the fact of what makes an animal halal or haram is not a question of the blood coming out of the body. This is a mistaken explanation that some people have given. It says it's haram if the blood remains in the body. If you cut the neck and allow it to bleed properly, then it becomes halal. Because if a non-Muslim, a Hindu, or a communist, a Buddhist, he slaughters that animal and says, in the name of Allah, you can't eat it. Right? You're not allowed to eat it. And if you slaughter the animal and didn't say the name of Allah, you're not allowed to eat it too. So it is not merely an issue of allowing the blood to flow or not allowing the blood to flow. No doubt, there is to a certain degree harm in the blood of the animal. We've seen this scientifically, blood carrying, you know, the germs of the body, purifying the body process, etc. We know there's some harm involved in there. However, wild game, again, has another quality, as another is put in another situation from domesticated animals. Like you're allowed to eat a wild donkey, but you're not allowed to eat a domesticated donkey. They're different. This is why in the scholars you have an animal in the wild which is called a boar. You know, there's question as to, is this edible, can we eat this or not? He looks like a pig. Right? He's got tusks. Uh-huh. Is it edible or not? But it's not a pig. The animals of the wild have a different ruling, according to Islamic law, to the domesticated animals. So where a wild animal, an animal of the wild, which is killed by your falcon, you know, a bird, you have a bird that you train to kill or to catch, or a dog, that these, if they die before they reach you, you're allowed to eat them. I mean, there's another quality, another factor which is involved there in terms of the way in which they live. If your trained dog, in a one day jump, you know, over the fence and killed one of your sheep, you can't eat it. See, this is in the case of hunting other wild animals. Well, as I said, there is difference of opinion concerning. Yeah, some say, well, you know, it looks like he belongs to the same family. He has similar, you know, forms. But if you look at the wild boar, his lifestyle is different from the pig, which is raised locally. If you see the hyena, for example, the hyena, he looks like a dog, right? And he will eat flesh, but he eats dead flesh. And the Prophet ﷺ said, you may eat it. Yes. Halal. And what happens is that those people in Egypt, in Lower Egypt, they commonly eat the hyena there. You know, those who talk about the flesh of the hyena, if you read about it in the encyclopedia, they tell you, it's I mean, the comparison between it and dog flesh, for example, is quite large, different. The flesh is sweet. It is not foul smelling or anything. I mean, though we maybe feel repulsed by the idea of a hyena, however, there are people who eat the hyena. And it has been permitted by the Prophet Muhammad.
The crab.
Crab.
Yeah.
Well, see, the living in the water and living on the land is not an issue of whether something is halal or haram. You know, what is an issue is whether, as a land animal, it kills by the tooth, or it flies and kills by the claw. Now, the crab does not kill by the tooth. Does not teeth. So it's halal. Whether it's half in the water, half on land, or lives on the land all the time, whatever. It's halal.
But some people argue that it has a claw, the right claw.
But the Prophet ﷺ said that the birds which kill by the claw are prohibited. The land animals, wild animals which kill with the eye tooth are prohibited. Does the crab fly? Does it bite with the eye tooth? No. We can't do that. See, some people will say, for example, you had some scholars who ruled, for example, that the shark was prohibited. Because in Arabic, in the past, it was referred to as the sea dog. They said, you can't eat a dog on land. They said, you can't eat this one. Similarly, the porpoise was prohibited because in Arabic it was called khinzir al-bahr, a sea pig. So the ruling in Islam is not according to what you call the animal, but what the animal is in fact. Right? Sea animals are halal for us, land animals which kill by the eye tooth, wild animals, and birds which kill by the claw are prohibited. Other than that, halal.
How about snakes?
Well, you have some snakes which kill with the eye tooth. Those that do, you would then have to say are haram. And those that don't, are halal. You could not prohibit all snakes. So we have a means of determining those which are halal, those which are haram.
Which of these is more authentic? The killer snake or poisonous snake when you see it at sight? They are not good. Because the Prophet has said sometimes, don't kill a snake.
No, he said if you find a snake in your home, right? And this is specifically referred to Medina, actually. So, I mean, although this has been generally looked on a whole, when he was referring, he talked about in the homes in Medina, right? You find a snake in your home. You are told to command it to leave because snakes, particularly those in the homes in Medina, some jinn live in snake form. If it does not leave after you've commanded it, then you are permitted to kill it. Well, you can't take it. Well, the jinn, I would say it understands any language, but the jinn of an area will understand the language of that area. It's like a dog, for example, right? People who train dogs, for example, in Germany using German, you try to use English, it's not going to work. Frogs? Very easy. And it's very easy. Do frogs kill with the IT? Frog's legs. It's a delicacy in France.
and one of its peers. The issue came up later as to why it's not like the import is not France because of the
imported? Well, really, France doesn't, not usually, maybe it was prepared in France. But the French, because the French, they, I mean, it's bought outside of France. I mean, you have many countries that are producing it, the frog legs for the French.
Yeah, they are imported. Somebody is importing in the kingdom. And it was thought that it was the point of the right now. It should not have been imported in the kingdom because it is not able.
That's false. That's not according to me. See, if you're going to say it is not edible, then you must bring evidence from the Quran or from the Sunnah. We don't have, I mean, what some people may say, well, it comes under the general category of khaba'ith, you know, filthy things. But what is filthy to you may not be filthy to somebody else. You can't use that, because that is varying according to culture and society, you know. I mean, what is known to be filthy by all people, then that's another situation. What may vary from society to society, you can't. Chocolate coated ants, bees, people eat these too. Halal. Okay. You know, in Indochina, what they commonly do, leave fish, they eat, right? They leave it to rot, and the juices that drip on it drip. You know, they put a plate of rice underneath, and when it's good and rotten, then they eat it. You'll find it offensive to smell, you'll be sick to your stomach, but it's a delicacy amongst them. It's just different culture. You cannot say it's prohibited. You know, like they have a desert lizard here, they call the dop, right? It's a fat bodied lizard, which was presented to the Prophet ﷺ to eat. And before he ate of it, one of his wives told him, "Well, you know what this is?" And he said, "No," and she informed him that this was dub, so he didn't eat it. Right? But I think it was Abdullah ibn Mas'ud was there beside him, so he asked, he said, "Is this prohibited?" He said, "No, it was just in the area where I'm from, it was not there, and you know, I don't have a liking for it." So he went and ate his and ate the Prophet. This is just customs. People have different tastes, likes and dislikes. I mean, some of them have been taught for, you know, in their part of the body. You may find this in books of fiqh, even, you know. Especially the Hanafi fiqh. Because they have generally done a lot of speculation, you know, using the mind to reason out many, many different things, going beyond the text. So you'll find quite often they've ended up, you know, prohibiting or allowing things which are not. It's quite a few. It, as a school of thought, it's the one which is the farthest from the Quran and Sunnah.
Some sweets contain some pork fat, gelatin and all that.
Well, it should be prohibited. Yeah, if you determine that it contains it, then it should be prohibited to you. No, but this is the definition. This is the definition. See, that which is coming in food products, they have testing systems here, which are analysis, which have atomic analysis, and pork has a particular pattern which they put the food through. If they identify it, this is not brought in the country. But animals which are slaughtered in Britain are considered to be halal, even though they are not according to Islamic, what we call Islamic method. Right? As long as they're not strangled or clubbed to death, etc. The necks are cut, that is sufficient. Without the saying Allah's name over it, it's not a requirement for them. We're allowed and we've been given permission to eat it. That's another issue. I know some people have taken the position that if they do not say Allah's name and cut the neck of the animal the same way that we do, then it's haram. But actually it's an extreme position. The more correct position is that as long as the people are Christian people or Jewish people as a whole. Some people say, well, you know, they're not the Christians like the Christians of the time of the Prophet ﷺ, you know. No, of course they are. The same thing. They were talking about Allah's tree. It's in the Quran. You know, these are the same people who are allowed to marry their women and eat their food. The animals which they slaughter. It's not an argument. As long as they don't take, if they take another name other than Allah's name, or if they kill the animal with electricity, or strangle the animal, this is known to you, then it's haram. But usually, I know in America, they use a gun, right? Which is a stun gun. But it doesn't kill the animal. It just gives it a blow to the head, which puts it unconscious, so they can control it. This is just for purposes of, you know, speed in handling the animal. That is still halal, as long as it's determined that this does not kill the animal. Then it is halal. If it is determined that it kills the animal, then it becomes halal. And as far as we found out in the States, what was being done is the animal was not killed. It was still living when they slaughtered it. They have a vegetable source of gelatin also. Because you can get jello, which is from vegetable sources. When you take God out of the picture, what you have is what is known as survival of the fittest. The law of the jungle. And this is why when the people who proposed the Darwinian theory, when they started to fit man into the picture and give images, they would always put the image of the European man as the one in the end. The others, you know, who were the Asian man, the African man, these were stages of evolution. So this was like justification for their colonization of the rest of the world and the rape of the various societies, because they were the fittest. They're the ones who, you know, survival of the fittest. Justification. It's all about, you know, who has the most power and can use it to their own personal benefit. So science, you know, in what is known as modern Western science now is leaning towards finding justifications for this concept, which remains, although, you know, there have been changes, because as anthropology, you know, found the earliest of men, or what seems to be the remains of the early men, kept finding them in Africa, they ran into a problem here. So, black Americans, you know, made a big noise about this in the Smithsonian Institute there in Washington. You know, the first man, he's presented as a European man. Everybody else is our apes, right? The first man is a European man. But this conflicts with, you know, even the evidence that they've gathered. So, eventually, this year, or just last year, the end of last year, They closed down the exhibit for the evolution of man and put the first man as being, you know, a dark-skinned, you know, African-Asian mixture of a man. You know. So their own research is causing them to have to back down off some of these positions. But still, you know, in the minds that produce the literature, etc., this concept is still, you know, there. Man's existence is by accident, and whatever you can get out of this life, that's what it's all about. And this is also why you find in the West the Hindu philosophy has become very popular, because the Hindu philosophy of reincarnation, it fits in with this materialist approach. Whatever you can get out of this life, do it. Have a good time, you know, get the best. Because when you die, you got another chance. You know, you can come back and try again, you know, get some more, whatever. So, you know, you're sort of absolved of really having to do good, per se. Though in the theory, as the Hindus teach it, you know, you do go through stages. If you're a bad guy in this life, you know, you go down the evolutionary ladder. You know, you may end up as an ant or, you know, a worm or something like that in the next life, right? However, you know, the Westerners, they key in more on, you know, you just got another chance. And so you find a lot of people coming up now and talking about their earlier lives. They're doing, putting people under hypnosis and talking about, oh, they were this in the time of the Romans and they lived these different lives they went through. So it's sort of promoting and more this idea, you know, of just take what you can. Human responsibility to your fellow man. It's not important.
What is your opinion about hiding it? Particularly in the plant, among the plants, you have hybrids, which are produced by two different animals. You are changing. As an example, in a particular rose plant, you can have a variety of colors.
Mm-hmm. Now they're producing the blue rose and the white rose. Yeah.
This is a hybrid. Which is the attribute of creation, or which is the attribute of human knowledge?
Well, this is knowledge, human knowledge of the workings of the animal kingdom has allowed man to manipulate to a certain degree. Not to create, he's manipulating only. He's not creating, he's manipulating. The ability to produce a white rose existed in the rose plant. Or to produce a blue rose. They exist in the rose plant. That ability is there. Man, with his knowledge of the, you know, genetics, etc., you know, has been able to manipulate so that this ability is brought out. You know, we have the mandarin, you know, cross between the tangerine and the orange, you know. But the thing is that these have not really produced what we could say a new species. It is still within the same family. Some of the hybridization will take place even naturally. Some of it takes place even naturally in both the animal kingdom as well as the plant kingdom. So this is not beyond, or this is not evidence for evolution, and this is not beyond the concepts of special creation.
Came across a hadith in Bukhari, volume 4, page 335, So one of these rooms has a duty and the other has a skill. If you mention those for that duty, you must accept it.
Well, of course, Maurice Bucay felt that this was unscientific, and on the basis of this, he argued that, you know, hadith, really literature, cannot be really trusted. I mean, you can only trust it in as so far as it agrees with what is scientifically known to be fact. However, poison of the cobra. You know, and we've always known, that if you are bitten by a cobra or you drink some of its poison, it will kill you. Yet, we are now using that poison for people who have heart problems to help their heart problems. You have a number of different medicines and medicinal techniques now which are employing what was commonly known in the past to be harmful. So just because human science has not reached the point where they have not researched this in depth, it has not become a point of research to determine, just because we have not found that, does it mean that the hadith is not unscientific? No, all we can say is science knowledge today shows us that fly will carry microbes and so on, so, and that this carries certain diseases. However, that does not deny the possibility that within the fly it carries an antidote to these diseases. This is we could say this is an area where Muslim scientists have failed. Because science in the Muslim world is following the West. After the period of colonization, the rise of European powers, the decline of the Muslim countries, we find that science also went into a decline. Muslims lost touch. So mostly they are serving and working in Western institutions and following Western trends. However, if Muslims were independent, developing their own research centers, etc., etc., this is an area of research which could possibly be followed. Because when I look at something like that, right, why I would take that position is because there are so many other things that have proven to be true from the Prophet ﷺ. For example, and I mentioned this to you all before, Prophet ﷺ had informed us that it is disliked to sleep on one's stomach. It is only in these last 10 years that scientists, doctors now tell us you should not sleep on your stomach. You should not even put your child to sleep on its stomach. They're saying this is a common factor in the cot death, SDS, sudden death syndrome amongst children. For grown people, the main cause of back problems, the problems in the discs and curvature of the spine, etc., they say it's caused from sleeping on the stomach because there's no support for the spine when one sleeps on one's stomach. So when we look at that, and there are other things that the Prophet ﷺ has spoken about, which in our recent times, we've come to realize and to understand. The prohibition of pork, for example, in more recent times we've found out, biological evidence for the harm that there is in it. We understand that, what has been given to us by the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, commanded of us, this is based on revelation from Allah, and it is the truth. The fact that we don't have the evidence to understand that truth does not mean that it isn't the truth. So we don't, as Muslims, for example, in Western tradition, a fly falls in the drink, you throw away the milk. It's gone. In Islamic tradition, the fly falls in, dip that fly in, you throw him out, and you utilize that milk.
You don't waste.
So when we consider the Muslims, for example, in situations where their food, drink, etc. is limited, etc., who are save themselves by being utilizing this, not being turned away, without having to wait 50 years from now when finally science comes across the antidote in the fly, you say, alhamdulillah, they followed the revelation and benched. As the Muslims who did not lie on their stomachs, who circumcised themselves, you know, did not drink blood, did not eat pork, etc., those who followed the commandments of Allah in the Quran or through the Prophet Muhammad's direct teachings, have saved themselves, have benefited in both this life as well as the next.
The question of evolution is generally Buddhist, and then it's more than to be passed up.
Evolving to be faster? No, I mean, we can see that there is development. In Japan, they just had it in the newspaper just recently, that this generation of Japanese are taller and heavier than the last generation. Their diet has changed. It affects the people. Now you start to feed people, you know, like the man who now trains specializes in athletics. You're giving him a special diet and learning all these techniques about muscles and so. Sure, there is development. But does he become a bird? Does he be, you know, he's changing his, he's no longer a man? No, he's still a man. So development in men, we don't deny this possibility. Well, sex change, basically, we say, when we say, use the term sex change, this is induced. I mean, you may have people, you know, who are what they call hermaphrodites, people who have, you know, both male and female organs, and at a point in their life, one may dominate the other, or depending on their upbringing, one, you know, they may, parents may consider him to be a boy, and then later on, as the others kick, the hormones kick in, they change over and they're considered a girl. This is like a natural process which happens, you know. Whereas in the case where the unnatural way, where an individual decides, well, I just want to be a woman now, you know, homosexuals decide, I don't want to be a man anymore, I want to be a woman. So they surgically change that individual, pump him up with hormones so that, you know, he doesn't grow beard anymore and, you know, etc. Physical changes take place in his body. You know, man's ability to mutilate man, it's nothing new. Castration of the past is a version. Because, of course, when a person is castrated when they're young, they used to do this in Rome, you know, to keep the boys in the choirs, you know, be able to sing those high notes, you know. They castrated the kids, you know, so they would be able to, you know, it affected them physically, of course. When you, you know, make certain manipulations in the body, this can cause certain other physiological changes in the body. This is nothing supernatural or beyond what could be expected.
Birth of baby, what is the origin of the origin of life being immortal, with the desertion of the world, you would stand on that, because you're saying that there's no evolution out of the attribution, that a classic origin implies evolution out of the
future. Well, he is taking, you know, a verse in the Quran where Allah says that he created, you know, every living thing from water. What this refers to, whether it is literally liquid water, aquatic origin, or as some people, other people propose, that water is made of H2O, hydrogen being the primary particle as far as we can, you know, basic atomic structure goes, as you know, the primary factor in all of living systems as we know them, whether it is that or it is the other, we cannot argue, you know, either way, though we would argue that water was not, in other words, man did not come out of a water being that, you know, crawled up on land and eventually evolved into a man. But water is essential to man's existence. The human body is mostly water. The huge proportion of water in the human body. And all of the living organisms that we know, this water is there. I mean, we could say that the Quran actually, you know, has pointed to a fact that science now is able to put together, that water is a key factor in all living organisms. That in the process of their individual development, you know, as one is produced from that one, water is involved in, is a key element.
One, just to reinforce what you said, philosophy deriving from the Greek philosophy, friend of the mind, if I remember this correctly, and science, which is from the Latin, which is knowledge. So the two things are separated together, and they can easily be took from one to the other. So I'm adding to your solution. Okay, having said that, genetic science, how is it in Islam? It is a science, it is a knowledge. Should we teach our children to become genetic engineers, genetic science, or not? Something to be encouraged or not?
Well, I think there's an aspect of genetics which may be useful. For example, you know, they have developed certain strains or working on developing certain strains of wheat or certain plants which will have certain other organisms along with them which will be resistant to certain other organisms. You know, so this involves the process of genetic engineering. You know, within the limits of helping to, or aiding man in utilizing the resources that God has given him, fine. But now when you're using it in the sense of, oh, I want to create the perfect man, you know, I want to remove all the problems, you know, that cause people to go this way or to go that way, so then this kind of create now a new man, this is where that science has gone astray. Where we may, for example, look in people who have certain genetically transmitted diseases, which helps us by the knowledge of genetics, will help us to determine such and such a person, they are likely to have such and such offspring, and we need to monitor pregnancies and so on and so forth. This is beneficial. But now when we use it in the other way, well, from this now we're able to determine whether you're getting a boy or a girl. So now if you're getting a girl embryo, you abort that. You know, you try again. You keep trying for a boy. Now it becomes distorted. Because you're taking life. Unjustifiably. So, I mean, science, you know, or what knowledge is available of the universe is a gift from Allah, which could be used Islamically, acceptable to God, would be an act of worship, it's in the service of man, recognizing the greatness of God, or it can be used against the way of God. You know, as Allah describes Satan, you know, as trying to get man to deviate, he will come to him from one side and the other, and he will encourage him, and until he tries to change the sunnah of Allah, he will command him to change the sunnah of Allah. Allah's sunnah or the way of Allah in his creation, he will try to change it, make it something else. This is the satanic way. And that's the satanic use of the knowledge. And that's with all knowledge will exist. We'll have both sides, either the godly Islamic use or the satanic use. So the science in and of itself, we don't say it is un-Islamic. No. How you use it will determine. Its origin, the knowledge is from Allah. So it is Islamic in its origin, in the sense, in the pure sense. How you use it keeps it in the Islamic vein or takes it in the satanic vein. Any questions from our sisters in the back? No, it's not true. It was a fairy tale, you know, which yes, another fairy tale.
Yes.
No, wishful thinking. See, what happens is that Muslims in a state of weakness where they are looking at really what they have as being somehow deficient, looking at themselves as deficient. You know, the West now becomes, so now somebody from the West, you know, they're looking for a miracle. You know, like they just had in England, I read in the paper recently, a man there opened up an eggplant and he found Allah written in the eggplant. And people, Muslims now, are making pilgrimage to this man's home to see this holy eggplant. See, this is the state that Muslims are falling into, you know. I mean, Christians are famous for this stuff, you know. But Muslims, you find them, you know, caught up in this idea now. And of course, it is nonsense. You know, we don't accept it. But it keeps cropping up. You know, I remember some years back, they had a picture of the bronchial tubes of the lung, and some doctor is supposed to have found written on everybody's bronchial tube, La ilaha illallah Muhammadur Rasulullah. And they showed the picture, but of course when it happened, they manipulated, you know, the picture is a very grainy black and white picture, and they manipulated it to find that. You know. Somebody found a fish, you know, in India, you know, with Allah written on the side. But see, if we get caught up in this kind of foolishness, I mean, these are just what we could call flukes of nature, and much of it is, you know, exaggerated and amplified. You see, if you're going to accept that, now you're going to make pilgrimage, when the Christian finds a fish with a cross on it, what are you going to do? And for sure, he'll find one too. What are you going to do? You're caught. So of course, for us as Muslims, we don't, our faith is not based on, you know, what we could call flukes of nature. This is not the basis of our faith. Our faith is based on firm knowledge of revelation which has been given to us, which applied in our lives we see as something beneficial and real, that improves the quality of our lives, improves our character, our moral character, you know, improves all aspects of our lives. This is why we do. So we don't subscribe to these kinds of, you know, because even individuals, what happened, the same thing happened. Roger Garudi, right? You know, former head of the Communist Party in France, who was a presidential candidate, he accepted Islam. And the Muslim world went wild. You know, Roger Garudi accepted this great philosopher, and you know, then he was brought around the Muslim world to give talks here and there. Fine, if he's giving talks, why he accepted Islam, fine. But then people started to make asking him fatwas, you know, to give interpretations of the Quran. And of course, the man doesn't have this kind of background knowledge, but because he was a philosopher. And they, instead of when they, you know, gave him something of Islam, they sat him down and started to teach him, you know, as a child again, from ABC. Because when you come into Islam, you have to go back to the beginning, you know. They allowed him to come in as a philosopher. You know, in a philosophy, he has an explanation for everything. And of course, when he put his mind to the Quran, he could find explanations. And of course, what happened is that these explanations were in contradiction to what we know to be correct. People tried to correct him. You know, of course, a philosopher, he can't back down now, you know. He can't back down. A philosopher, he's not going with the facts anymore. It becomes a question of ego and all these other kinds of things. So he ended up making heretical statements. Now this man, prior to this, he was given the, you know, title award and, you know, big for Islamic knowledge and, wow. We have a man, now he's looked at as a heretic. So he, there was a benefit that could be taken from him to the degree of the knowledge that he had. But Muslims, you see, in their, you know, in this state where, you know, anything coming from the West now, they're just gone crazy. You know, this man, he accepted Islam, and they exaggerated his position, and of course caused him, well, some of the blame is with him, of course, but they put him in that position of heresy. And as I said, it's a reflection, basically, of the weakness of Muslims today, that they are like what they call the drowning man, you know, clutching at the straw. You know, he's drowning, anything, he sees a straw floating by, he's drowning, he grabs it, thinks, you know, of course, if you sit and think you're going to grab a straw, it's not going to keep you afloat, but, you know, you're drowning, you grab onto anything. So, this is the approach. Very unfortunate. And of course, it means that we will continue to find these kind of stories circulating in the Muslim world, and more, you know, examples of Allah being found in nature, trees and plants, etc. But it is for us to understand the reality of such phenomena, and to try to educate those around us to the ridiculousness of considering these things to be holy and etc. Big figure. No, Ibn Rushd, he made some errors in, we could say, in rationally trying to deal with some of Allah's attributes.